I thank the organizers, of which I am one, for giving me the opportunity to speak. So, given the short notice, it's going to be a blackboard talk. So I'm going to talk about phonons, vortex lines, vortex rings, and rotons. And in fact, we'll go back to phonons in a sense that you'll see towards the end of my talk. Okay? And this is based on work in collaboration with Solomon, and then with Bart, who's also in the audience, and Ricardo, who's going to show up later. And then work in progress also with Kate Eckerle, a student at Columbia, Sebastian Garcia Science, also a student at Columbia, and Hermes Mitsu, who's now postdoc Zurich, and the work in progress also with Ricardo. So, main topic? The main topic is the application of effective field theory techniques to these systems, in particular to fluids and superfluids. So, all the way up to here, whatever I say will be applicable both to fluids and ordinary fluids and superfluids. Okay. At the classical level, so with the understanding that for ordinary fluids at finite temperature, we stop at the classical level. For superfluids, we could also do quantum computations. And rotons, I'll review for you what rotons are and why they are interesting systems to study. For rotons, whatever I say will be applicable to rotons in helium 4, okay, or in any other superfluid that has rotons, proton-like excitations. Okay, now. Having said that, for simplicity, I will only focus on superfluids because the analysis is technically simple there, technically simpler there, but it extends also to ordinary fluids as well. So in fact, let me review, well, you all know what the difference between a superfluid and an ordinary fluid is, but let me review it for you. So so we say usually that a superfluid is a fluid with zero viscosity, and that's true. But is this working, by the way? No?
Yes, it is.
OK, thank you. Yeah. And that's true. So superfluids are fluids with zero viscosity. But viscosity in hydrodynamics is already a higher derivative effect. Okay, it appears to the first non-trivial order in a derivative expansion. So from the viewpoint of effective field theory, perhaps it's more important to characterize zeroth order differences between these two systems. And the zeroth order difference is this, that in a superfluid, the only vortex configurations that are allowed are lines. Okay, so the velocity of the fluid goes around the line like this. The line is the only place where vorticity is non-zero. Okay. Whereas in the bulk of the superfluid, vorticity is zero. Okay? Whereas in an ordinary fluid, we can have arbitrary, fairly arbitrary vortex-like configurations. They can be very complicated three-dimensionally, and perhaps more importantly, they can be very soft in the sense that the velocity can be as slow as you want. So there's no energy gap for vortices in ordinary fluids. Whereas in superfluid, the circulation, that is to say the integral of the velocity around a line like this, is quantized. And so the energy is also quantized. The kinetic energy associated with this fluid flow is also quantized. And in fact, the energy per unit length of a vortex is, not only is it non-zero, it's in fact logarithmically divergent in the IR. Okay, so it depends on the size of the container logarithmically. In fact, I'll talk about how we can understand this log from the viewpoint of RG running. Okay, so let's focus on the superfluid with the understanding that, and in particular, whenever we talk about vortices, we will talk about vortex lines. With the understanding that if we want to apply our results to fluids, we can do it provided we restrict to vortex configurations which are like this, meaning whose typical transverse size is much shorter than any other length scale in the problem. And these solutions exist in ordinary fluids as well. Okay, so from the viewpoint of quantum field theory, so let me try first to describe in effective field theory terms the bulk dynamics of the superfluid, and then I will describe the lines. So from the viewpoint of effective field theory, the superfluid is a system in which a conserved charge is spontaneously broken, okay. For instance, for liquid helium, this could be helium atom number, the symmetry, the U1 symmetry associated with helium atom number. So it's spontaneously broken. This corresponds to Bose-Einstein condensation, if you want, in condensed matter terms. And not only that, but we need to have a finite density for that charge, okay? So these two requirements are conceptually independent. You could have systems that have spontaneous breaking without having a finite density. You could have a system with finite density without having spontaneous breaking. You could have both, or you could have neither, okay? So a superfluid is a system that has both, okay? In some homogeneous isotropic state. Okay, once you have that, then you can apply Goldstone's theorem and effective field theory techniques for Goldstone's bosons and write down the most general action compatible with the symmetries for the low energy degrees of freedom, which are the Goldstone bosons of this breaking pattern. In particular, they are the phonons of the superfluid. And so these are conveniently organized in the following way. I'm reviewing known stuff, but I'll try to explain where it comes from, okay? These are conveniently organized in the following way. You define a scalar field, phi. This is a Lorentz scalar, okay? Notice that the presence of a background charge density breaks Lorentz invariance because from the viewpoint of Lorentz transformations, it means that I have a four current which gets a VEV, and so in particular the VEV being just a density and not a special current will be along the time direction, okay? So this breaks Lorentz invariance, but it's a spontaneous breaking because even for what we call non-relativistic system in the real world, Lorentz invariance is broken always spontaneously and never explicitly, and meaning it's broken by the state of the system. And so it's convenient to have a field theory description that makes the spontaneous nature of the breaking explicit, okay? So the way we do this is you define a Lorentz scalar, okay? And you expand with some symmetries, which I will describe in a second, and you expand the action of the Lorentz scalar about a Lorentz violating background, okay? And these are the fluctuations, the phonons, okay? And notice that this scalar here, not only does it break Lorentz, it also breaks time translations formally, okay? But if you assume that there is a shift symmetry on the scalar, like this, for any constant A, which is nothing but the nonlinear version, the nonlinearly realized version of the charge you started with, okay, the U1 charge you started with, then any time translation that is formally broken by this background can be made up for by an appropriate shift of the scalar. That is to say, there is an unbroken linear transformation of time translations, which are generated by the Hamiltonian, and charge transformations, which are implemented as this shift. So this is nothing but, in field theory, the usual statement that for a system at finite density or at finite chemical potential, you should use that Hamiltonian, okay? It's the same statement, but in a different language. So it's consistent with that statement. And so the symmetries that we should focus on, if we believe this viewpoint, are this shift symmetry for the scalar and Poincaré. By the way, this shift symmetry, the fact that the original U1 symmetry acts like a shift tells us that this phi is really a phase, okay? So you can think of this as saying that you have a complex scalar, for instance, that describes a complex field with a a boson with a U1 symmetry, and you expand, as usual, the complex scalar into a radial mode and into a phase, okay? The U1 symmetry on the complex scalar now acts like a shift on the phase. So this is really like the superfluid phase field in more standard language. Okay, anyway, so if we want to construct the most general effective action now, we should write down the most general Lagrangian compatible with the symmetries. To lowest order in the derivative expansion, the only invariant that we can write down is this, okay? It's shift invariant because we have a derivative, and it's Poincaré invariant because we are contracting derivatives. And for technical reasons, it's convenient to take the square root. It just simplifies computations, but of course, this is an invariant, so the square root is also invariant. So let me call this square root X, capital X. In fact, it's a bad name for what comes after, so let me call it Z, maybe. Okay? Traditionally, it's called X, but I'm going to call X something else later, so let me call it Z. Okay? So notice that Z, when I expand the scalar about this background, is mu plus dot dot dot. By the way, sorry, this mu really has the interpretation of the chemical potential because of the fact that it leaves unbroken, that background leaves unbroken this combination, okay? So this is the Hamiltonian, a finite chemical potential mu, so that mu is the chemical potential. So this Z starts with mu and then it has perturbations coming from here, so it can be interpreted as the local chemical potential in the presence of long wavelength perturbations. Okay. So now if you take this Lagrangian, sorry, so the Lagrangian that we would write down is the most general function of this Z plus higher derivative terms. Okay? So in particular, when you expand in pi's, when you expand in phonons, you get pi dot square minus, I'm being super sketchy about overall coefficients, okay? C square, gradient of pi square, where C square is the south speed, which is now expressed as certain combinations of derivatives of P, when I just Taylor expand P about that background, plus interactions that look like this. I have a bunch of coefficients, again, related to derivatives of P, times derivatives of pi, this could be time derivatives or special derivatives to the n, okay? Simply because each phi comes with a derivative, okay? And so each pi comes with a derivative. So these are the interactions, and so with this action you can compute, for instance, scattering amplitudes of phonons, okay? So in a process like this, the amplitude would go like energy to the fourth, simply because I have one derivative per field, typical energy E, with some angular structure that you can compute. I won't write it down because it's boring, but it's very well defined, and in fact, I will match it later to something else. Okay, so that's it. So for the bulk dynamics, there's nothing more than this, provided we assume that all the low energy degrees of freedom are those enforced by the symmetries, that is to say, the Gostin bosons. Questions so far? I think the first to write down the relativistic action for superfluids. By the way, I'm doing everything relativistic, but one can take the non-relativistic limit at any point if one wants to do so. I think the one to do to write down the relativistic action for superfluids first was Son, and whereas for non-relativistic superfluids it was Wilczek, Witten, and someone else that nobody. No, I mean that.
That person is in the audience.
The person that nobody remembers is in that paper. I'm sorry about that. I'm even being recorded, so okay. I don't remember who that is. Okay, now, in the presence of vortex lines, well, I would like to try down. So a vortex line is really a solution for the superfluid flow with that.
Kreiter.
Do you know him?
No, but.
Or her?
I don't know.
Yes. Thank you. Okay, in the presence of vortex lines, well, I would like to write down an action for the vortex line, okay? and an action that also includes the couplings to bulk modes, that is to say phonons. Now notice that this is tricky to do because, well, at least at first sight, because a vortex line, I mean, it looks like a line, and in fact, in certain experiments, you can really see the lines, but that's sort of misleading because the line is a placeholder for a very complicated three-dimensional fluid flow, meaning that it's not that the velocity field is localized at the line. Vorticity is localized at the line, but then when you want to solve for the velocity field, you have to take the line as a, if you want, as a boundary condition, and then write down a Biot-Savart type integral for the velocity field. So the velocity field is a very complicated integral expression, okay? And of course, the velocity field carries energy. So the fact that the velocity field is totally delocalized tells you that it's not that the energy of the line is localized here. In fact, it's log divergent. So it gets contributions from all scales, okay? Now, however, it's possible to do the following, okay? It's possible to write down an action that only takes into account where the line is, okay, for some coordinates, x mu, and here we are going to do something like bosonic string theory, okay? X mu as a function of a time coordinate and on the worksheet of the line and a sigma coordinate along the line, okay? And couple this degree of freedom to the bulk degrees of freedom, okay? And so in this sense, the fact that this velocity field is totally delocalized will be simply a consequence of the fact that there is an interaction between where the line is, between the line and the bulk degrees of freedom. So the line will act as a source for the bulk degrees of freedom. The bulk degrees of freedom will acquire a non-trivial configuration, and that will carry energy. So like any other field theory, okay? However, to do that, we have to change description a little. The reason is this. So from the viewpoint of the scalar phi, so remember that phi is a phase field, okay? So from the viewpoint of the scalar phi, the line is a topological defect, okay? If you go around the line, phi goes from zero and goes back to 2 pi, okay? Goes back to 2 pi. And so it's not single valued about the line, and it's not obvious how to use the scalar to write down local couplings between the line and the scalar. One possibility would be to insist on the symmetries, which we have to, and say, okay, since the scalar shifts under the symmetries, I can write down the derivative of the scalar. The derivative of the scalar now is single valued because there's no difference between 0 and 2 pi at the level of derivatives, okay? And so I could write down derivative couplings between the line and the scalar. But this would be analogous in ENM to having a magnetic monopole, for instance, and saying, well, the electric potential is not single valued about the magnetic monopole. I can take gauge invariant combinations like F mu nu. That is certainly single valued, and so I could write down a coupling between the magnetic monopole and F mu nu. But that would be a dipole coupling, not a monopole coupling, okay? So the question here is, can we write down a monopole coupling of the line to bulk degrees of freedom? And the answer is contained in the analogy with the electromagnetic potential. Yes, but we have to go to the magnetic dual, okay? So instead of phi, we're gonna use a two form. Let me call it A2, A2 mu nu. I'm writing this script A because I'm keeping ordinary A for another object later, okay? So this is the magnetic dual. And it's a two form because in four dimensions, the odd dual of a scalar is a two-form, okay? And certainly with a two-form, now we can write down a coupling, which is the analog of, let's say, this coupling that we will write down for a gauge field coupled to a point source, okay? The analog of this is the integral of the two-form on the worksheet of the string. This is, so let me call this Kalb-Ramond action, because that's what it's called in string theory, okay? So this is gauge invariant for the two form. It's important that this be gauge invariant because the duality in the bulk, I'm going to be explicit for a second about the duality in the bulk, but the duality in the bulk only works if there is a gauge invariance for the two form. Otherwise, the counting on degrees of degrees of freedom doesn't work out. So it's gauge invariant up to total derivatives, meaning that the gauge transformation that you get of this action is a boundary term, okay? And it's obviously Poincaré invariant. It's reparametrization invariant in tau and sigma, which is not an obvious property, meaning it's not obvious that we should impose it. For instance, we can discuss this about this offline, maybe because it will take some time, but if you take an ordinary string, by ordinary, I don't mean superstrings, I really mean like a material string, like a shoelace or something. And so its action is not reparametrization invariant in the sense, the same sense as superstrings, for instance, or cosmic strings. And the reason is that a shoelace breaks certain symmetries along the string itself, okay? So in particular, it breaks Lorentz along the string itself. So there are Goldstones associated with that. And those Goldstones are physical, so motion in particular along the string is physical. Whereas if you take an infinitely long cosmic string or superstring, motion along that string is totally unphysical, is pure gauge. And here it's the same. The question is, if you want, it's an assumption. Should we impose reparametrization invariance or not? I would say that for ordinary fluids, we should, because for ordinary fluids, the only characterization of a vortex line is that it's a place of non-zero vorticity. That's a purely geometrical characterization, and it doesn't change if you start moving along the string itself. So velocity of a string along itself shouldn't carry energy. Whereas for a superfluid, I would say it's a consistent assumption. Why do I say that? Well, yes, usually we define a vortex line in a superfluid by the same condition as in an ordinary fluid. But it's in realistic situations like helium-4, for instance, it's a microscopic. It has microscopic thickness. So at those distances from the string, we have no reason to trust the hydrodynamical description. Okay? The hydrodynamical description is an approximation that is valid at long distances. So there's no reason that we should be able to export concepts like vorticity all the way to those distances. So from that viewpoint, I don't think we are allowed to claim that we know what a vortex line is in a superfluid. We can have an effective description, like the one I'm trying to provide here, but there has to be assumptions. That's what I think, but if you have a different opinion, we can discuss about it, because I would like to understand this better. Anyway, so it's a consistent assumption, so we impose reparametrization invariance. Yes?
If you drop reparametrization invariance, is there other ways to couple the string to the background?
That's a good question. For instance, I was giving this talk at CERN last week, and Richkov said maybe it's an accidental symmetry in the sense that at these ordered derivatives, you always have it. But I would say, so for instance, you see, here, to every parametrization invariance, it's crucial that you have this anti-symmetric structure, meaning that these objects are contracted with the mu nu and the mu nu is anti-symmetric, it's a two-form. So I would think that at this level of derivatives, you could come up with other structures. For instance, I don't know, if I add here d sigma x alpha, d sigma x alpha, in the same integral, no? Now, this is not reparametrization invariant. It has the same ordering derivatives in the sense that d sigma doesn't count as a derivative because, you see, the background solution is, for instance, x3 equals sigma. So d sigma is 1.
Didn't you suppose the gauge symmetry now? Because
you've been very hard there. Yeah, very good. So you're saying maybe it's an accidental symmetry once I impose the gauge symmetry. Maybe you're right. I don't know. That could be true, actually. No, but we can certainly. So, for instance, the very fact that that there are longitudinal Goldstones for a string, for a material string, tells you that to lowest order in everything, there is an action for those, no? So.
So you can write other terms which don't involve A.
You could write other terms which involve A. Okay, it's a good question. I don't know. Yeah, it's a good question. Maybe.
Maybe another question, because reparameterization variance is a gauge symmetry, so you can always use reparameterization variance, and just what you're saying, there should be extra master's degrees of freedom,
exactly,
like one propagated along the...
Yeah, that's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying.
So it's really assumption that
there's no extra degree of freedom along the string. It's an assumption about that. You're right. Yeah, yeah, it's exactly that. Okay, so... more questions about this? By the way, this comes with a coupling, lambda, which you can interpret as some sort of charge per unit length. The fact that in superfluids, vorticity is, circulation is quantized, tells you that this coupling is quantized. When you work out the algebra, it turns out to be quantized in units of 2 pi. Okay. So let's be explicit about the duality now, because it's slightly different from ordinary Hodge dualities, meaning at the tensorial level it's the same, but there are scalar factors up front that come from the fact that our theory is a self-interacting theory. There are interactions here, it's not a free theory in the bulk. So the claim is this. So usually you'd say the Hodge duality works this way. You'd replace d mu phi with epsilon mu nu rho sigma d nu, a two form rho sigma. Okay. Here you can do it in several ways. You can work out the relation between the stress energy tensor and the fields, or the current and the field, because there's a conserved current coming from the symmetry, or you can do it with the standard Lejeune transform trick to get from a field to its Hodge dual, okay? In any way you do it, there are scalar factors here, so let me call them f of d phi square and some other scalar here, g of dA2 square. Okay? And these are fixed. These are fixed by the Lagrangian. Once you know P, you know what F is and what G is. So the tensor structure is the usual one for Hodge dualities, but there are no linear corrections. And once you do that, okay, remember that phi was mu t plus pi of x. So this gets replaced by a two form, which has the following entries. So 0, 0 is usually 0 by anti-symmetry, 0 I is 0 on the background, and it has fluctuations, so let me normalize them with n, the number density, mu as usual as a conjugate variable n, the number density, so n times AI of x. And A2ij is same normalization, n epsilon ijk xk plus another vector bk of x. Okay? So A and B are zero on the background, so the only background is an epsilon ijk xk. So the background that was mu t now becomes purely spatial because of the epsilon tensor there. And these are fluctuating fields now, A and B. Okay? Remember that we have a gauge invariance, this gauge invariance. And yeah, we need it because otherwise we have too many degrees of freedom, okay? Because we start with 1 degree of freedom, a scalar. Here formally we have 6 degrees of freedom, okay? And it turns out that we have enough gauge redundancy and the constraints coming from the gauge redundancy to eliminate all of them but one at the level of wave solutions, okay? The statement is the following. In some gauge, you can fix a gauge in which A is purely transverse and B is purely longitudinal, okay? In this gauge, A plays the role of a Coulomb-type potential, so it does not feature, when you look at the equations of motion, it does not feature wave solutions, but it can mediate long-range forces, okay? It obeys an equation of the form Laplacian of A equals zero in the bulk equals sources in the presence of a coupling like that to strings, okay? So equals sources. Whereas B is also sourced by strings like that, but it also features wave solutions, okay? And the fact that it's purely longitudinal tells you that B is really, in this gauge, B is really a describing sound waves. Okay, so this is a choice of gauge. So B is the phonon, if you want, whereas A is a Coulomb-type potential, which has no counterpart in the phi description. Okay. And at the level of propagators and Feynman diagrams, this is described like this. So the propagator of A has the form of a transverse projector times 1 over k squared. Okay, so it's a purely spatial propagator, so it really obeys Laplacian equals something. Whereas the BB propagator is a longitudinal projector times a more standard, there's an I if you want, pedant, I omega squared minus speed of sound squared k squared plus I epsilon. Okay. And the actions, so we were starting from P of Z. Okay, and as usual for Auger duality, you have to do a Lejeune transform to get the new action. Turns out that the new action is rho of y, where y is the square root of dA2 squared. Okay, why am I using these letters P and rho? Because P is really, when you work out the stress energy tensor associated with this action, it's really, and you remember that Z starts like the chemical potential para perturbations, P is really the pressure as a function of the chemical potential. So if you know the equation of state of the superfluid, you immediately have the Lagrangian once you express the equation of state as the pressure as a function of the chemical potential, okay? When you go through this Hodge duality, you get the conjugate description in terms of energy density, rho, as a function of y. Y, if you look at this background, y starts at n plus perturbation. So you really get rho as a function of number density. So the Hodge duality at the level of field theory corresponds to the standard Lejeune transform between pressure and energy density and chemical potential and number density at the thermodynamic level, okay? Now, this coupling is enough to describe the lowest order interactions with the bulk modes. As far as interpreting the string as a source for the bulk modes go. But since so far this is the only dynamics, this is only the only source of dynamics for the strings, we have to check what the equations of motion are coming from here. And it turns out that they are degenerate, okay? They are trivial at this order, which means that we should go to one higher order in the derivative expansion to get some non-trivial dynamics. What do I mean? I mean that if I put I'm choosing this gauge for simplicity, tau equals physical time, that is to say Minkowski time if you want, and I put for simplicity for the moment A2 on its background, meaning I neglect the A and B fluctuating fields there, okay? So the equations of motion that you get are trivial. The tau A, the Tx cross the sigma x equals zero. This cross comes from the fact that the background is epsilon ijk. Now, why do I say it's trivial? Well, this is the projection of the velocity orthogonal to the string, because this is the longitudinal vector. So the projection of the velocity orthogonal to the string is zero, okay? The projection of velocity longitudinal to the string is unphysical to begin with because of this reparametrization invariance. We said that reparametrization invariance is really associated with the fact that the motion along the string or perturbations along the string are pure gauge. Okay? So bottom line is that there's no physical component of the velocity. So there's no dynamics in this system so far, as far as the string is concerned. Okay? Now, which means that to get dynamics, we either should give up this, okay? So we should start including perturbations, okay? Or we should go to higher orders in the derivative expansion. It turns out that two things are related, meaning that if I look at processes like this, I'm being schematic here. Suppose this is the worksheet of the string, okay? I have perturbations of the string, which I'm gonna denote like this. I'm looking at a perturbed string. The perturbed string via the Kalb-Ramond coupling can source A and B. Okay? A and B propagate into the bulk, and I can have diagrams like this. Okay. So it turns out that these diagrams are log divergent in the UV because I'm taking the limit in which the string is infinitely thin. Okay, they're log divergent. And as usual, for a field theory, for the local field theory, UV divergences should have the same structure as counter terms, meaning as possible terms you could have written down in the Lagrangian to begin with. Okay? These counter terms that we could have written down to begin with take the form of a generalized Nambu-Goto action. Let me call it Nambu-Goto prime. Okay? So Nambu-Goto is what? Well, Nambu-Goto would be the square root of the determinant of the induced metric, okay, times a tension, okay, a coefficient. Here, that coefficient is promoted, so let me call it script T, is a generalized tension, is promoted to a function of other invariants we could write down with the ingredients at our disposal. Meaning, one of the invariants is that Y, the local number density, okay, it's invariant under all the symmetries. Another invariant is this object, the induced metric, inverse, for instance, or without the inverse, times the four velocity of the surrounding fluid. The four velocity in the scalar description is a properly normalized, suitably normalized version of d mu phi. In the osdual description, in the two-form description, is a suitably normalized version of this guy. It's an invariant of the fields, it's invariant under everything, okay? And this is invariant under Poincaré as well, because I'm contracting, I'm confused about the index contraction, BART. Because these are indices on the worksheet, where I this bulk vector. What was the index contraction? You see my confusion? We have to draw the paper. The idea, sorry, this is wrong. This was H alpha beta, where H is another possible induced metric. It's the induced metric where instead of using eta mu nu in the bulk, you use u mu u nu in the bulk, no? U mu u nu, d alpha x mu, d beta x nu, okay? Now these are, alpha and beta are worksheet indices, mu and nu are spacetime indices. Okay, and so it turns out that at this order in derivatives, which is one higher order than Kalb-Ramond, this is all there is, meaning you can prove that these are the only independent invariants that you can write down, or combinations thereof. There's two independent invariants. One is this, and the other is this. Okay? And so the tension of the string, the effective tension of the string, now can depend on these scalar quantities. Okay? And in fact, when you take into account these diagrams and the fact that they diverge logarithmically, It tends to depend on these scalar quantities, meaning that there are counterterms here that have to cancel, there need to be counterterms there that have to cancel the divergences here, okay? But the fact that these are logarithmically divergent after renormalization tells you that the coefficients that we have here run with scale, okay? So in particular, the tension, which I can define as the lowest order coefficient in tau, that is to say, tau evaluated at the background for y, which is n, and at the background for this guy, which is 1, is the tension. For instance, it obeys an RG equation of this form. W, well, W is rho plus P, so the background enthalpy density. This mu is not the chemical potential, now is the renormalization scale, okay? So this is a usual statement that, like we were saying, the energy per unit length of a cosmic string or of a vortex line in a fluid or a superfluid scales logarithmically with the size of the container, okay? Meaning that once you remove the UV divergence associated with these diagrams, okay, and the idealized infinitesimal limit for the thickness of the string, okay, you remove that. There is a prediction, which is that the scaling with an infrared scale, now which is the size of the container, is this, okay? You still need, as usual, an initial condition in the UV to integrate that equation, but that's just a measurement. You can measure the energy per unit length in a container of a given size. That's a measurement. You fix the initial condition at any scale, and then you evolve that equation in a trivial way. Okay, so in particular, a prediction of this analysis is that now, if you want to study the spectrum of excitations for a long string, okay, these go under the name of Kelvin waves. They were discovered by Lord Kelvin in 1880, not for helium 4, of course, but for ordinary fluids. He said, let's take a vortex, which is very long, and whose vorticity is localized in on a cylinder, okay? And let's look at perturbations that are much longer than the size of the cylinder. And he discovered that, of course, I mean, the computation in hydrodynamics, especially in the language of those days, was extremely heavy. But what you discover is that, well, in our language, it's very simple. It's just the tension evaluates out to be, if you just expand the Lagrangian in powers of small perturbations, you get the tension, and you look at the dispersion relation, is the tension evaluated at the scale k, so I'm assuming that they have a wave number k, times k squared over this number. And this is exactly what Lord Kelvin found, meaning he didn't phrase it in this way, but it had a log, it had a k squared, it had the right coefficients. And so it's nice to rederive the same result in a completely different way. But let me, since I'm almost, I should stop at 10:30, right? Yeah.
Yeah, maybe a little bit before the question.
Yes, okay. But if you guys have questions, you should ask them in real time, no? Okay. And what you can do now is also use this action. So we have an action, no? We have the bulk action, which I wrote down there. Let me write it down here again. Bulk action is the purely determined by the equation of state of the superfluid as rho as a function of y, which is the local number density, okay? And then we have two pieces on the boundary, sorry, on the worksheet of the string. If we are interested in excitations of the string, we have to keep them both, because otherwise, as we said, the dynamics is degenerate. If we are interested just in the string as a source for the bulk modes, we can just keep this guy, okay? And then you can expand them in perturbations, both in the bulk and on the string, and you can write down, I mean, you can just read off all the interactions between bulk degrees of freedom and string degrees of freedom. For instance, in the paper with Bart, we computed the absorption cross-section for a phonon coming in and exciting two quanta of Kelvin waves. Okay, these are called Kelvons. These are funny because the Kelvin waves are only have one polarization per direction, so it's always a circular polarization. And since there's only one polarization per direction, you cannot combine two circular polarizations to make a linear polarization. Okay? So for instance, if you really wanted to start with a linear polarization, let's say like this, at t equals zero, you let it evolve. The equation of motion is first order in time derivatives. You see omega equals something, k squared. That first order comes from here, the fact that we have a single d tau here. And so it's enough to give the initial geometry, and then the system is completely determined. We don't need to, you cannot specify the initial velocity. The initial velocity is determined by the equations of motion. So you start with a linear polarization like this, and immediately the system evolves like this. There's a circularly polarized wave going up and a circularly polarized wave going down. And only at t equals zero do they match into a linear polarization. Anyway, so let me move to where I want to get, which is rotons, okay? So these rotons are excitations in helium 4, which is experimentally well understood. So if you plot the spectrum of elementary excitations in helium 4, okay, as inferred from neutron scattering data, you see that at low momenta, there's a linear slope like this, and these are the phonons. And if you want, the dynamics of these guys, including their interactions, are well described by this effective field theory. Okay? But then at microscopic distances, so at hard momenta of order of 1 over the Bohr radius, let me call it P star, 1 over A, there are features. There's a maximum, then a minimum, and then it goes up again. Now, it turns out that experimentally these are fairly, this is a fairly thin line. Okay, these are stable excitations. And in fact, they're stable if you think about it, because suppose you are at the minimum. I'm not sure about the maximum, but if you are at the minimum, you cannot decay into a bunch of phonons because so if you start to sum up phonon momenta to get to here and the corresponding energies, which are linear like this, okay, you end up with too high an energy. So somehow you have too little energy to decay into phonons. Okay, phonons would be too energetic for you. So these are stable, and these excitations close to the minimum are called rotons. And they're interesting because they correspond to a minimum at finite momentum. So from the mechanical viewpoint, they're very counterintuitive objects, because if you are right at the minimum, the group velocity is exactly zero. So you have finite momentum but zero velocity. If you are left of the minimum, you have finite momentum and opposite velocity. The group velocity is negative. Okay, and this is experimentally verified, meaning you can shoot a roton, hit an atom, and the atom would recoil in the counterintuitive direction. Okay? Now, there was an ansatz by Feynman many decades ago that indicated an ansatz really for the wave function of the many body helium system. Okay? So it's a many body wave function ansatz. And it correctly reproduced the qualitative features of this curve. It was off by a factor of 2, maybe, but the qualitative features were there. And when you look at this ansatz close to the roton minimum, you see that the rotons behave like a toroidal, from the viewpoint of how the atoms move, behave like a toroidal flow, like a smoke ring, okay? Or really like a vortex ring. So here we have vortex lines. Remember that the velocity field around the line goes like this. If I curl up the line into a ring, the velocity field goes like this. Okay? Etc. And the claim is that phonons and rotons are on the same curve, whatever that means, meaning that people say, well, they are really the same excitation, but at different momenta, okay? Now, it's not obvious what it means to be the same excitation, so the only meaning that we could find is they have the same quantum numbers, okay? But how can a photon have the same, and on the other hand, if it's true that, that there is some truth in this Feynman answers that a rotor is like some microscopic version of a vortex ring, how can a vortex ring have the same quantum number as a phonon? And this will be, if you want, the conclusion, the last topic of my talk. So from the point particle viewpoint, suppose I want to describe a phonon. So a phonon is like a compression wave in a wave packet like this, moving that way. And I want to describe a vortex ring moving that way. Okay. So I claim that, well, the moment you choose a position, you break translations. So from the viewpoint, from that viewpoint, okay, they both break translations, and there's gonna be, in the point particle description of them, there's gonna be Goldstones associated with the breaking of translations, which are nothing but the positions, the position vector. Okay, but from the viewpoint of rotations, they also break SO3 down to SO2. Okay. For the phonon, this is nothing but the statement that the little group associated with having a definite momentum k is SO2. Okay, so it's the unbroken rotation subgroup of the momentum k. For the vortex ring, it's less obvious, but again, it has to do with reparametrization invariance, meaning that if this were a material ring, the breaking, perhaps this is a little technical, so we can talk about it offline, but the breaking for a material ring would be SO3 cross SO2 down to SO2. Meaning that the moment you have a material ring, you also have to take into account the volume elements associated with the material ring and the fact that they also define some sort of, let's call it coordinate system, so that the degree of freedom associated with rotating the ring around its axis is a mapping between this internal coordinate system of the volume elements and the spatial coordinate system, okay? So it means that you have an extra SO2 symmetry and you're breaking spatial rotations and that extra SO2 symmetry down to some diagonal SO2. For the vortex ring, we already concluded that, or assumed that I have reparametrization invariance along the ring. I have no degree of freedom associated with rotating the ring around its axis, okay? And so I'm really breaking the spatial rotations down to whatever is obviously unbroken there, which is the SO2. So from the viewpoint of C of the, in the point particle limit, from the viewpoint of symmetries, broken and unbroken, there's no difference between a phonon and a vortex ring, okay? So it's natural to assume that a rotor, if it's really the microscopic version of a vortex ring, is also described by that pattern of symmetry breaking, okay? And you can use, and I'll just write down the conclusion, you can use the celebrated Cosette construction, so the Kallan, Coleman, West and Zumino Cosette construction for spontaneously broken, in this case, space-time symmetries, to write down an effective point particle action for these guys, and now it's a unified point particle action, which describes both phonons and rotons, depending on where you expand the action, to describe these guys as point particles now coupled to bulk modes, meaning to much softer bulk modes, like soft phonons. So the point particle action. So point particle phonons and rotons is an integral in time, and now I'm doing just the non-relativistic limit because it looks simpler, of the generic function of x dot minus the fluid velocity, the surrounding fluid velocity, dot n. So each of these guys, since it's breaking SO3 dot SO2, has two Goldstones associated with the breaking of rotations. These two Goldstones can be interpreted as polar and azimuthal angle of some unit vector n, which in this case is nothing but this, and in this case is parallel to k. Okay? So the Goldstones for these point particles are the position and the orientation. And the action has to take the form of a generic function of relative velocity with the fluid dot with n times the famous invariant that we were talking about, could be what we call the z, okay? This is d phi squared. So this contains the bulk phonons. So the claim is that this describes the interaction of a point particle with these symmetries, could be a phonon or could be a roton or even a vortex ring in the point particle limit, with bulk phonons, okay? And as a check that this is correct, we computed, now using this effective field theory, the scattering of a hard point particle phonon, so let's call it the hard phonon, with soft phonons. So the hard phonon is the point particle described by x and n. The soft phonons are the bulk degrees of freedom that make up the fluid velocity and this z, okay? You compute the scattering amplitude, and you get exactly the same scattering amplitude that we would get from the original bulk action, okay? So this is a non-trivial check that all this makes sense. There's two different description, you can apply both of them in a particular limit when you talk about phonons, and they give exactly the same result. So this gives us confidence that this is the correct description for point particles with symmetry. So we apply the same description to rotons. You see now this F has different forms depending, well, I mean, this F is, if you want, the Legendre transform of this guy, because this is the Hamiltonian as a function of K, and the F is the Lagrangian as a function of the velocity. So once you know this from experiments, you can just take the Legendre transform and get F. And then you can expand it. If you expand it about small momenta, you get the phonons. If you expand it about a minimum, which means small velocities, you get the rotons. And so for the rotons, we computed the scattering amplitude, for instance, for roton phonon going to roton photon, which is a class phonon, which is a classic computation in Landau and Kolatnikov that they used to determine the viscosity of leading four. And we found that we mostly agree, but they missed some terms. Of course, their techniques were totally different. They were much more heuristic, and they missed some interactions, which are there, and not are there in the sense that they are free parameters. They are there because once you know this curve, and how this curve depends on external pressure, which is also experimentally measured for leading four, the interactions in that F are completely fixed. There's no free parameters, okay? So we claim that we have a better result than Landau and Kolatnikov. Can I have just 1 minute? I think the most fun application of this thing is once you have an effective action, and in fact we can even write the relativistic version and covariantize it and couple it to a generic metric g mu nu, we know how these objects couple to gravity, which is not trivial because, for instance, if you drop a material object in a fluid, you have the Archimedean principle that tells you just measure how much water you displace and you know whether you will float or not. But here, if I ask you, what's the effect of gravity on a phonon or a roton? Will it float or will it sink? It's not obvious what's the volume displaced, no? Or even in the classical limit, if I give you a wave packet for a sound wave, it's not obvious how to do the computation. I mean, you have to solve the equations of motion, but is there an effective point particle rule like the Archimedean principle? So the claim now is that here, this is totally a well-defined question because we can couple this system to gravity just by covariantizing. And we claim that phonons float and rotons sink, but they sink in a orientation-dependent way, meaning a roton like this sinks, a roton like this sinks, a roton like this first wants to reorient itself and then to sink. And I don't know if it's experimentally measurable. For instance, if you have a finite temperature when you have a thermal bath of phonons and rotons, maybe there will be a separation of phases that I don't know if it's detectable. Thank you very much.
Any further questions for Alberto?
So I think I didn't quite understand the comparison. So for given F, there's a definite
Yes, because very good. Yes, because you see, I have to be quick, but around here, h is CSK. Okay, you know the velocity. Okay, and so you take the Lagrange transform, and so you know what f is, and it only depends on CS. Okay. Now, if you know how the pressure depends on the chemical potential, which means if you know this function, then you also know, in this description, how the speed of sound depends on chemical potential. So there's a one-to-one correspondence. No? If you know this, you know CS as a function of chemical potential. So everything is determined. It has to work. There's no free parameter in the comparison.
Would you always think of it as CS times K? You're thinking about it just more.
Yes. So when I do the comparison for phonons, I mean, this is just a check now to see whether this is the correct description for phonons. Then for autons, we have no other description, so we have to use this.
Hard phonons are still really hard.
Exactly. Yes, sorry. Very good. I define a hard phonon, someone here, some guy here, and then I want to see the scattering with much softer phonons. I think it's a well defined limit, no? Yeah. Yes.
Is there maybe a difference between the low energy branch of the phonons and the roton region? Because the phonons are probably sharp, rather well-defined excitations, yes. Whereas around the roton, since I can go to a roton also from a big vortex, yes. Right, there is a whole continuum above the roton. So it probably makes this line to be smooth or like...
So I think large vortices are way up here somehow, meaning I think the first extra state here would be, they claim there is a two roton bound state somewhere here, although I think there are some, there's some controversy, I don't know if someone in the audience is an expert, but I think somehow the classical vortex rings are much, much, much higher in energy, so somehow they don't really interfere with this guy, you see what I mean?
I was just thinking that I think the roton I can smoothly distort into a larger vortex ring, right? Like I could imagine it. I mean, I would violate all kinds of conservation laws, like momentum, for example, but yeah. I could reach it from vortex rings, not only from phonons.
Well, it's not obvious solid. That will be. So, for instance, let me tell you. So, the answers that. Feynman came up with for the many body wave function was based on some Bose statistics consideration. What are the lowest energy possible deformations you could do to the system while preserving Bose statistics? And it depends on a parameter K. And what he discovered is that when you expand, when you look at this for very, and then you plug this into the Hamiltonian, okay? And you look, it depends it also depends on a free function, okay? I forget exactly how, but it depends on a free function. So now it's a variational problem. You try to minimize the Hamiltonian, the expectation value of the Hamiltonian with respect to this free function. And what you find is a curve like this. In particular, for low k, you have linear, and for larger k, you have a minimum. And so I think this tells you that if you tried to deform the roton in your way, it would be unstable towards collapsing immediately to the slowest.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes.
That's good.
Yes.
It's just, I think, like that we should maybe draw a width to these lines, which is sharp at low energies, and then it becomes smeared out.
I would agree, but in practice, from experiments, the message I take away is that it's fairly thin all the way, and then when you get to the two roton bound state, it becomes super broad. I think it's fairly thin. Yeah. Yes.
So you mentioned that you take the Lagrange transform of that. If some function is not convex, then the Lagrange transform is not convex.
Perfect. Okay. Yes. Okay. Well, I can reply now or offline. This is a technicality, but so if you want, I claim that the Lagrange transform. If you want, you cannot integrate out p, in the sense that, as you're saying, the dh. Over dp equals x dot now gives you x dot equals cs, which does not allow you to integrate out p, which means that you can keep an action in which you have both x and p, and you have to minimize both with respect to x and with respect to p. Meaning, it's the same variational problem. Usually, we are able to do the variational problem in two steps. First, we integrate out P, and then we are left with the Lagrangian for X. Here is a Lagrangian both for X and for P.
You just have X as a function of P, not X. So what do you do with that?
No, I'm saying I'm claiming that the X you should use is PX dot minus H of P.
Okay, which turns out to be px dot minus cs in one dimension. In three dimensions, there's also that n, you have to be careful. But this is the action, and now p appears as a Lagrange multiplier, and you keep it around. But it's a good point. And in fact, I mean, technically, there are higher derivative corrections here that make this guy go up experimentally. So if you take into account these higher derivative corrections, now the problem is well defined. You take the Lagrangian transform, and then you see what happens. In the limit, again, it's equivalent to having a Lagrange multiplier. It's a technicality. Yeah, but it's a good point. It's a good point.
Okay, great. Let's thank you again.
Thank you.